In thinking about the path of love or the path of inclusivity, which has been particularly honoured by the mystics in all of the traditions, the mystics who not only transcend dogma and ideology, but who regard it with great tenderness, not despising it because they understand its function, but they also understand its constrictions and that they don't need it. You know, if I speak to you about Hazrat Inayat Khan, if I speak to you of Hildegard of Bingen, if I speak to you of Hafiz, if I speak to you of Rumi, if I speak to you of Ramakrishna, if I speak to you of Vivekananda, if I speak to you of Mahatma Gandhi, if I speak to you of any great soul, Teresa of Avila, these are all people who were never going to be contained by a single body of thinking. At the same time, they are not inviting us to think with anything but gratitude of people for whom what we call one path, one religious tradition, is wholly nourishing. Because those people are going deeply, and we can be grateful to them. Perhaps they're not all going deeply. It doesn't matter. Some of them are going very deeply. Some of them are discovering in going deeply, as for example, Bede Griffiths did, William Johnson did, Teilhard de Chardin did, Thomas Merton did, great intellectual Catholic priests. And I often rather think, oh, I could have done my doctoral work on them, but I was compelled to do it on Rilke, so never mind. That was rewarding too. But some of those great intellects had discovered that they went more deeply into their own tradition with more to love through embracing other traditions. William Johnson's case, it was Zen. Bede Griffiths' case, it was the Vedanta. Thomas Merton's case, it was looking towards the East, both to Buddhism and Hinduism. And others would say, I am simply going more deeply into my own tradition, where there is everything to know. And that's also true. You know, this is part of our delicious variety. We're not all marigolds. Some of us are rosebuds. Some of us are thistle. Some of us are gorse. We're not all marigolds. And to refer to a question that is so often asked of me and again was asked today by Rebecca. How should we respond to somebody whose spiritual formation comes from the Christian tradition, where conversion has been a very strong compulsion, more than an impulse, a compulsion? In the Jewish tradition, for example, there's no compulsion to convert. In fact, it's rather difficult to convert, even if you want to. And some conversions are not honoured if you want to go to Israel. And Israel offers the right of return to every Jew, but not every conversion is regarded as the right to return to Israel. Not keen on conversion. So how did it come about? How did it come about that Christianity, which is an outgrowth of Judaism. Very interesting to consider that, isn't it? Well, I have a couple of theories that are only theories. They're not the truth. One is that in the 3rd century, Rome was converted. Christianity became an imperialist religion. It continued to be a religion of magnificent transformation. It continued despite itself and despite the human beings who thought they were doing their very best to be a religion that has truly served the outcasts, the forgotten, the despised, the dying, the being born. Christianity has never ceased also to carry forward that mission of service that was exemplified by Jesus. I've been to Hawaii a few times, quite a few times in recent years for a variety of reasons, and I finally read James Michener's great big fat book called Hawaii, and I was sort of in awe because I had thought, oh, it was a potboiler, but actually it has some sort of potboilerish elements, but very skillfully done, and so much research. And I was reminded again about how lepers were treated. And in the end, the only people who would go and live with the lepers and, of course, die of leprosy were Christians. You know, we can't overlook that either. However, from the time of Paul onwards, and I have great affection for Paul too, but from the time of Paul onwards, there was this feeling that so great was their rejoicing in this new message, which was one of forgiveness and inclusivity, that this message should be spread. And then I think from the time of the imperialization of Christianity, there came to be the development of a certain tendency which is in us all, which is to insist on a certain point of view and to insist that this point of view is entirely justified, and justification is a big word in some Christian circles. Now, there is a group of scholars called the Jesus Seminar, and Robert Funk, F-U-N-K, Robert Funk was the main writer in this body of scholars. And they were mainly, but not exclusively, American scholars, mainly, but not exclusively, scholars whose first language was English, but all of whom had a lifetime of academic familiarity with the languages of Scripture. And they have gone through the Scriptures to really try to discern which are the teachings that we can regard as relatively authentic, and which are the teachings that we can regard as likely to be less authentic. And one of the teachings that is likely to be less authentic is, I am the way, the truth, and the light. No one goes to the Father but through me. It is also possible with a good will and a good heart to see that even if this teaching was remotely authentic, it simply means not through me, a physical person, not through me, a being called the Saviour, but through what I bring, through the teachings that are most so much more easily authenticated, which are not just the teachings of the sayings, but the teachings of the actions. And that's why I'm telling you this story in a rather long roundabout way. Because the actions of this teacher, who has been more culturally influential directly and very indirectly through the interpretations of other people, in his actions, he was a supreme teacher of inclusivity. That is, he went out of his way in almost every recorded example to bring in the people who would have been called the other. And that's why he is my teacher. That there was no other. Love one another as I've loved you. I think that's pretty simple. There's a ring of authenticity to that. As I have loved you means unconditionally and without worrying who's come to the well, pointing out that the person who picked up someone from the side of the road who had been battered and bruised and robbed of his dignity as well as his money, was not a honoured temple-going Jew. It was a despised Samaritan. It was an asylum seeker. I think we can be very moved by that. Yeah. It's an invitation to loving despite everything. Doesn't mean liking everyone's opinions, doesn't mean agreeing with everyone's opinions. It certainly means knowing right from wrong. But it means at the level of soul, at the level of spiritual nature, good, bad, ugly, beautiful, despised and honoured, we're in it together. And Buddhism, of course, also understands this with exceptional subtlety. So I want to go on speaking about spiritual practice just for a little bit longer. I want to just give some ideas about spiritual practice. But before I do, I'll just read this tiny little passage. Where have I got it? 66, I think. This tiny little passage from Brother Lawrence. Now, a brother in a monastery is, generally speaking, somebody who used to come from a less educated class and had a more humble position within a monastery. Somebody who came as an aspirant with a vocation to be a seminarian or to be a beginning monk, who was going to be ordained as a monk, as a priest, would generally have come from a more privileged background, better educated. He would have, had to know several languages and, be a well-educated person. So there's a lot of opportunity for humility in being a brother. Actually, some people also make it a choice. Even in my lifetime, there were still people choosing to be brothers rather than priests. And sometimes it was a conscious choice to really resist the temptations of hierarchy. Because the temptations of hierarchy are very seductive, aren't they? You know, they are very, very seductive. So here we have Brother Lawrence. I want you to notice that. It's not Cardinal Lawrence. It's not Pope Lawrence. It's not even Priest Lawrence. It's Lawrence. Having found in many books different methods of going to God and diverse practices of spiritual life, I thought this would serve rather to puzzle me than to facilitate what I sought after, which was nothing but how to become holy gods. In other words, how to be living in practice in everything I do, because Lawrence knew, wise being that he was, that all of life is spiritual practice, that your spiritual practice is your life. It's not something separate from it, but there are also times when we want to be very focused on what we can receive. However, Lawrence says, I renounced for the love of him, meaning God, everything that was not God, which means he had to renounce nothing at all. And I began to live as though there was none but he and I in the world. I worshipped him the oftenest that I could, keeping my mind in his holy presence, just returning my thoughts, and recalling it as often as I found it wandered from him, just like you do. You know, you're sitting in meditation and you suddenly remember, oh, I was supposed to send that note with, you know, child number four. Oh, and I didn't. Oh, I forgot to. Oh, I didn't. And then we remember, I can deal with that. Back to the breath. Recalling it as often as I found it wandered from him, I found no pain in this exercise, no small pain in this exercise. And yet I continued it notwithstanding, because it brings me holy freedom. And if I may so speak, a familiarity with God wherewith we ask the graces we need speak of. Now, what he actually did, and what he said in the longer version of this, is that whether he was on his knees in front of the Holy Sacrament, or whether he was doing the dishes in the kitchen, his mind was with God. That our mind being where it needs to be, we don't need to call it God, our mind being in its place, our senses being attuned to gratitude, to a more peaceful existence, to a more creative, delighted existence, to a more forgiving existence, to a more sorrowful existence when that is appropriate. That it is not dependent on those external circumstances. How refreshing and freeing that is. All right. As a little girl at school, we had to write AMDG on the top right hand of all of our pages. Ad Maiorem Dei Gloriam. Ad Maiorem Dei Gloriam. You did it too. AMDG on every top of the right hand page, so that everything we would do was for the greater glory of God. All our pathetic little efforts, you know. Je m'appelle Stéphanie. Amoua ma samat, amamo samat e samat. As though really it would, you know, be for the greater glory of God, and as though God needed our greater glory, but it had real purpose. Because it let us set an intention. I don't think I understood that, but it let us set an intention that what we would do was of benefit beyond ourselves. I wish I had understood that. I thought it was sort of all down to me, you know, which is a lonely place to be. And it makes you both too important and horribly unworthy all at the same time, which is quite an achievement. And we go on being too important and horribly unworthy through most of our lives, don't we? I'm so glad you're laughing, Rebecca. I'm laughing too. Ad maiorem Dei gloriam. So there we are. We set the intention. And I ask you to entertain the possibility. Now, that's a gorgeous phrase. Entertain the possibility. Bring it in. Sit it down in a nice chair. Bring it a cup of tea in your best china. Give it a cake. I might tell you that Rebecca makes the best cakes in the world. And if you choose to come to Pitt Street Uniting Church on the third Sunday of each month at 3 p.m., and you stay for the entire glorious time, at the end of that time, you will receive a delicacy called a Rebecca cake. She makes these exquisite cakes. Lemon meringue is my personal favourite. Friand's are many others' personal favourites. Okay, so you are entertaining the possibility. Hello, here's the welcome mat. You are entertaining the possibility that as you awake each morning, you will set an intention for your day that is for the greater glory of all of existence. Could be very modest indeed. You might even set an intention by simply recognizing what the strength is that you will express or need today. That's a prayer. Beautiful prayer. Meister Eckhart says if your only prayer was thank you, it would be enough. Thank you for this day. Yeah. As you move through your day, your spiritual practice can be, I'd like you to entertain the possibility that as you move through the day, you can align yourself with your strengths. So sometimes it's terribly helpful to notice what strength you need and even put it on a page or on a little card. Particularly if you know that there is a hard day ahead. For example, it comes to me as I'm speaking to you that on some days detachment will serve us very well. Really seeing that this is part of the rising and the falling. And detachment does not mean indifference, but it means not being sucked in entirely to a drama that is not serving me well. Along with that comes a softening. Softening is also part of our spiritual practice. A new heart I will give you, and I will take out your heart of stone, and I will give you a heart of flesh. Softening. Softening our demands that other people should be as we would most like them to be, if only they would, and softening the demands we make on our own perfection, which actually quite interrupt it. And I've talked a lot about that. Softening also our self-pity, or if self-pity is not part of our repertoire, maybe a little bit of arrogance. Self-pity and arrogance quite go together. They're both defensive. Neither serves us very well. We all know them. We all know them. And we need not regard them with contempt. How ridiculous would that be? How ridiculous! We can regard them much more peacefully than that. We can regard them with compassion. They might feel that they have served us well, but actually we don't really need them as our heart softens. Now, is it occurring to you that with a softer heart you might be more vulnerable? I think that a softer heart brings a more spacious view in which we can afford to take things less personally. It might also depend a little bit on what we think a soft heart is, a more open heart, in which we take things less personally. So that, for example, while it absolutely behoves us, there, I've used that funny word again, to take really good care of ourselves, to move ourselves out of harm's way. I once had a teacher who said, "Why would you go back to be bitten twice by the same snake?" I thought that was rather good. I thought, I took notice. Why would you go back to be bitten twice by the same snake? But of course we do. We go back thousands of times to be bitten by the same snake until we recognize our relationship to the snake. And we also recognize that the snake is biting an ankle. It doesn't necessarily know it's Stephanie's ankle.
Why would I put my head in the lion's mouth? Put your head in the lion's mouth, the lion might be hungry.
But the snake crawls very close to the earth, and we don't always see it coming. The darling lion, for those of us who loved The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, is bigger. Sometimes it is the passive aggression, the withdrawal of kindness, the silence that kills, that is even more of a bite. So with our more compassionate heart, we both take better care of ourselves, and we see what is being done somewhat less personally. Does that make sense, Hilary? I want you to tell me 100% if it doesn't make sense, or any of you, tell me 100% if it doesn't make sense, and we might return to this afternoon when you're thinking about it together in your groups.
It's when you said the snake doesn't recognize Stephanie's ankle.
Yeah, that it's Stephanie's ankle, even if it's telling Stephanie everything that's wrong with her ankle, and has a parade of reasons why Stephanie's ankle is totally unacceptable, except to bite.
So that's the snake's rhetoric, it's not.
Yeah, yeah. It's the snake's rhetoric. Yeah. Very painful, what I'm describing to you. And I'm bringing it to your attention only because I'm also asking you to entertain the possibility of softening some of your attitudes and making them more spacious. And because I believe that you are courageous enough to be doing this while taking good care of yourself.
Stephanie, could you just say a bit more about the relationship between the snake biting and what you mentioned, the word passive-aggressive?
Yes, yes. I can say something about that, and I write so much about that. I write so much about that in two books that I'm sure you've got. One is Choosing Happiness, and the other is The Universal Heart, where I write, I think, a very strong section on transforming aggression, because I feel so strongly about this as a peacemaker, and because I have seen the suffering that I have caused, and I have seen the unbearable suffering that has been caused to others and to myself. And passive aggression is an hostility and a resentment that is not owned by the perpetrator. And I use that word perpetrator, even though we're all in it, you know. The person who believes that their resentment is such that they feel driven to behave in these ways, but because it is covert, they don't own it. Hillary, who in another lifetime, in this lifetime, worked in women's refuges, pointed out to me, and some others of you might have done the same, pointed out to me that very often people who are quite extrovertedly aggressive also really disown their behaviour. And actually, when she told me that, I remembered that, yes, I know that too. And that there comes to be, in families where there is huge violence and huge anger, as there is in families where there is very serious addiction, there comes to be a kind of secret so that we don't talk about it. We don't own it. We don't own it collectively, because the person who is most acting it can't own it either. Alcohol is a very good example. It's familiar to everybody who's grown up in Australia or New Zealand. There's no point in talking to somebody when they're under the influence of alcohol or drugs. But when they're not, it seems almost disrespectful to bring it up. Now, that's not always the case. You know, people are getting much, much better about bringing things up. But these kind of unspoken silences can also be part of extroverted aggression. However, what I wanted to talk about in response to Ruth's question was much more the kind of routinely disowned. You know, the person, you come with your good news and they somehow just spoil it. Not meaning to, of course, Ruth. Not meaning to. And yet they've spoilt it for you. Or you come in with a great excitement and they make it very clear that there is no atom of sympathetic joy. In fact, you feel awfully bad for having shared your good news. Or it might be that whatever you do, you've written a report and you've slaved over it, And they just, look, I didn't know whether I should point it out, but I just thought you probably would like to know that there's been another journal article since. There are countless ways. Or, for example, this works a lot in business too. You've discussed something, someone else owns the credit. There are just so many examples. Withdrawing of affection is a huge act of violence, hugely often wrapped up in disowning. You walk into a room. I'm sure I give examples like this in the books. Choosing Happiness, I know I give this example, this very example. You walk into the room. The atmosphere is frightful. And if anybody thinks that thoughts are not energetic forms, just remember this example. You walk into the room and you say to the person, "What's wrong? What's wrong?" You can feel it. You know, you're right over there and you can feel it. And the person's here. And they say, "Nothing. What's wrong with you?" Total disowning. So in passive aggression, it's very hard to unravel it because the person is probably very skilled, not only at disowning all the complications that would come with owning it, like shame and guilt and growing up. Growing up, very reluctant, many people very reluctant. What also happens there is that very often not only are you the source of the aggression, you know, they're only in this bad mood because, you know, you did something wrong. But now, because you tried to speak to them about it, you're an even worse person. This is a very painful routine. And we literally remove the sting from it when we recognize how little it has to do with us. Unless we are the practitioner. And if we are tempted to do this practice, coming awake is our antidote. The minute we recognize that we are puffing ourselves up or contracting into the body with a flood of self-pity, we need to shift our physical position. It's really, really interesting. We need to shift our physical position, and I would also urge you to shift your physical position when you're dealing with someone like that and to engage as little as possible. So that person says, you know, something that is just really cutting, and you know that they will never own it, and rather than defending yourself, you simply say, "Goodness, I see it differently," or some such, because you can't afford to engage with the passive aggressor when they're in flood. You can't afford it. There's no solid ground. This is also a spiritual practice. Do you see that? That you're bringing to it a more spacious mind, and you're also bringing to it a more truthful mind, because these are not behaviours that other people do who are unlike us. They're coping strategies that people have learned and haven't yet unlearned. And they do a lot of harm, don't they? They do terrible harm. And imagine being a person who thinks that's the way to move through the world.
Very sad.
Mm?
Very sad.
Yes, and very harmful.
Mm-hmm.
And very harmful. So it really is our... The freedom is ours to cultivate. The freedom is ours to cultivate. Let me finish this tiny sentence, Trish. The freedom is ours to cultivate, not to continue the harm, which is what I wrote about in Seeking the Sacred, and what I wrote about in Forgiveness. The temptation is to continue the harm by reacting. The spiritual challenge is to take the sting out of their harm so we can respond, if we must, much more neutrally, diffuse as best we can, remove ourselves from harm as best we can, and then try, if we need to continue to meet that person, to meet them in another space and another time. So please do ask your question.
What I was going to say is how you can get so drawn into that without awareness, and how you can sort of end up harming yourself so much.
Definitely.
By entering that place.
Yes.
Of thinking that you've got to fix it.
Yes, absolutely.
And so the secret, like you've said, is to remove yourself from that position of not responding and saying,
I'm so sorry, I'm done, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry. Because quite often in this dance, a lot of placating is required. And maybe in the placating, the person who's passive-aggressive often is unconsciously asking for a lot of placating. And sometimes in the placating, we are condoning the behaviour. What we've talked about is quite complex and subtle and challenging, but it's also through daily life, isn't it? It's also sometimes where we'll really meet the grit of our spiritual practice. We won't meet the grit of our spiritual practice probably on retreat. We have the opportunity to do a lot of yin on retreat and really to think through, and this is as vital as meeting those situations, to think through together how are we going to meet them. This is utterly vital. This is profound investment in the rest of our life that is unfolding from this very moment.
Can I ask a question?
Of course, Sandy.
I work with a lot of people like that.
Yes.
And I cannot imagine how... I can't visualise how you can physically remove yourself when an encounter like that is going on.
Yeah. And you can't always physically remove yourself. So the removal, to some extent, has to be within. Within, even. So I'm standing. I am moving more into a William Tai Chi posture. And I'm doing all this in my imagination only. And Sandy knows William's Tai Chi posture because she's been in Kyoto with me. And it was almost, the beginning was almost exactly as Lindsay showed us yesterday. So I'm standing and my knees are slightly bent, and I'm doing all of this mentally, even while I'm sitting in an office or I'm at a meeting or that other person is standing over me, either literally or metaphorically. I am moving, I'm remembering William, for example. I'm conjuring up William, who is this incredibly graceful, beautiful man with a Chinese body in this lifetime, and all the sweetness that we associate with that face. So,
Sandy's moving into her Tai Chi moment. She's channeling William. She's channeling William, and she's listening and she's nodding, and she isn't really there. And she isn't available for those arrows that are not Cupid's arrows. She is somewhere else. She's in a little garden outside a traditional Japanese house in Kyoto at the International House, where she discovered something about the beauty that is apparently absent in this moment, but that she can turn to with the power of a single thought. They might be quite alarmed when you smile. And Sandy, it won't always work. Sometimes it won't work. As I said this morning at meditation, if it works occasionally, that is wonderful. If it works even as you prepare yourself to be with those people whose behavior is toxic. If you think, oh, if you only knew of my Williamish antidote. And each of you can channel someone who you just feel has the grace and the presence, and that someone, of course, might be your own dear self in another mood, in another moment. And it won't always work. But, you know, it does work sometimes, especially as we prepare for those encounters that we dread. We are just much more flexible. And let me tell you, this is much, much better for the body than guarding ourselves, defending ourselves with all the constriction, with all the cellular constriction. Robert could explain this to us much better than I could, but the cellular constriction of fear is very bad for us physiologically as well as spiritually.
It kind of makes us more solid, so the arrow's got something to penetrate, whereas if you go into the Williams garden, you kind of, there's lots of spaces there, and the arrow just goes straight through.
Yes, or it transforms into Cupid's arrow.
Yeah, just does nothing for it to anchor into.
Yeah. And even more than that, the temptation doesn't arise for us to do our routine back, for us to defend, you know? And having a few phrases that just deflect. And I'm not saying that it's easy, but it's certainly not easy to be subjected to other people's toxic behaviors. It is not wholesome. It is not helpful. Just one more minute and we'll do the rest tomorrow. The last one that I wanted to mention today is to check your motive. To check your motive. And by that, I mean something so simple, which is your motivation. In bringing a different level of conduct, can be one of simple, delighted creativity and curiosity. Will this work? Will this bring me into better relationship with others? Will this bring me into better relationship with myself? You don't even have to call it spiritual practice. Call it curiosity.
In the same way that you could go to your meditation cushion motivated by becoming a great yogi. Or motivated by your desire to be enlightened in this lifetime, in this body. And some of us have been to Koya San, where they teach a version of Buddhism called Shingon. And one of the characteristics of this Japanese mystical form of Buddhism is that you are not necessarily caught on the samsaric wheel of life. You don't necessarily have to come back lifetime after lifetime after lifetime, which is, of course, also what Jesus taught. But you can be fully enlightened. You can come awake in this lifetime. It's very optimistic. But you could be motivated on your way to the cushion, or you could be motivated by your experiments with love on this day. You could be motivated by your desire for happiness on this day. You could be motivated by your willingness on this day to be part of the world's healing and the healing of your own divine self. Om Shanti.